We went from normal life, healthy child to acute lymphoblastic leukemia or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Are you tired of your scented cleaning products smelling and cleaning like meh? Then it's time for an upgrade with the power of Clorox Scentiva. With an uplifting scent that smells like coconut, Clorox Scentiva gives you powerful clean like Clorox, but a feeling like being transported to a tropical island retreat. Imagine putting your phone on Do Not Disturb, tuning out all the constant, just the feeling of warm sand in between your toes and a fruity drink in your hand. The ones with the little umbrella. Refresh your home to feel like an all-inclusive vacation by getting Clorox Scentiva. Also available in grapefruit and lavender scents at a nearby retail store.
This is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and I am your host, Liv. Okay, so today's conversation episode, like I hinted last week, is particularly suited to the god Apollo from this past week's regular episode, and that is because I spoke with Bettina Joy de Guzman, who is a singer and songwriter and musician of songs either in ancient Greek or based on ancient Greek poetry and epic, which is so utterly fascinating. She plays ancient instruments like the lyre, and she plays a little bit of the barbiton in this episode. We talked all about ancient music and ancient epics, Homer and the Homeric hymns. We just went off about mythology in general and talked about Madeline Miller's Song of Achilles and Circe. We talked about Achilles in general and all the intricacies surrounding his mother, Thetis, and oh my gosh, there was really so much. We talked a lot about Sean Bean in the movie Troy. Who wants to miss that? Not me. As you'll hear at the end, we talked for about 2 hours. I tried to trim it down because I never know how long is too long, but I couldn't cut out too much, so this is still about an hour and a half long. There's a couple little transition cues in there when we wandered off topic and I brought it back in the editing, but otherwise we just had such fun, such an incredible conversation. I love that there are people that I can just talk mythology and all of it, you know, in one place. So I really enjoyed this episode. It was really fun speaking with Bettina Joy, and I hope you enjoy it. Her music is incredible, and there's just so much. You can find more about her in the episode's description. There's a link to her website. You can listen to her music, and oh my gosh, so much going on. Ancient music is so fascinating and so cool, and please just enjoy this episode. Conversations, singing the words of Homer, ancient music and lyrics with Bettina Joy de Guzman. Why don't you tell my listeners, like, about yourself and kind of what your whole world is in the classics realm, because I think yours is quite unique in like how you do it and how you reach people and everything. So why don't you tell us a little bit more about you?
Okay. I am in an interesting space because, for instance, for Harvard University Center for Hellenic Studies, I have two appointments this year, which is as an associate. So it's like research stuff and associate for that. And it's an associate with a grant, which is rare. And also as visiting artist. And I think that pretty much, you know, that's a good way of defining why I'm so oddly or how I'm oddly placed, because I am a classicist. So my training, my fourth degree, as a classicist. The other ones were my bachelor's were in music, English and psychology, especially developmental and abnormal psychology. And then I went back for my fourth degree by accident, because I just love languages so very much. And it was like my fifth language at the time or whatever. I mean, I've at this point in time, I've studied 20. I'm not very good at all of them or anything. Fluency, whatever. You know, there's reading comprehension skills and stuff. But I mean, studying. I intend to live like my grandmother, to be like 100. She's 100. She's turning 101 this year. Wow. So I don't have any like limits to myself. Like, I must learn by this time. No, it's learning is a process. It's organic, right? So one day I was just like, I've been teaching piano. I was a piano teacher at the time, and that's all I was doing. It was so chill. It was so wonderful teaching children. I was already done with my, with my degrees. And I was like, yeah, I'm just teaching piano and earning quite well for, you know, somebody in my 20s. And then I decided, wait, hang on, what is this? Oh, look at that. Latin in the summer. Oh, that sounds like a fun language to learn. So I went in it. And the TA at the time, the instructor, was like, who are you? Why are you picking up this language so easily? And I go, I'm Filipino. I mean, Filipinos tend to pick up languages and music very easily. Like, we're just like known for that. So then they kind of reeled me in and said, well, you know, what are your plans? What are you doing? You know, have you thought about being a major in classics? I'm like, no. I mean, I'm already finished my major. They're like, you know, if you go in, there's only 2 years because you only have to do the languages part because you've already done like the major requirements since you already did English. And I'm like, I mean, that's intriguing. You know, I mean, I had at the time the money. At the time, that was before my child. Children suck all your energy and money, I swear, you know. So I'm like, yeah, all right.
That's why I won't have any. I want my energy and my money for me.
I understand that. I understand that. So there I was. I went in and, you know, I was in like maybe even like two semesters and maybe even the first one. And they were already it was a new program. It was like back in 2003 or something. And they were like, you know, we could use somebody like you in our PhD program. And at the time, believe it or not, they were offering me a stipend as well as a fellowship and a TA ship. Three things. You can't get that now.
Yeah, you know? I bet.
And in fact, that program now, they don't have PhD anymore. They only have up to MA. But, you know, I went in and at the time when they were asking me, what are your interests? What would it be? What would you be studying? I said, theater. So theater, ancient theater. And I said, and also music. And they're like, music. I go, yeah, you know, what did Homer sing? And they're like, well, we don't know. I go, what do you mean you don't know? At the time, they didn't know. And there were only like a few people who had been looking into it. So there was West, ML West. And he's well known for many things besides music. There's Pullman and West who was working on ancient Greek music, like they have this book and documents of ancient Greek music and so on. So I looked at that and I thought, this is exciting. And I took a class on meter, and everybody else was like, we have a whole semester on meter. And they're all like, oh my God. And I was like, oh, meter, yay. And they're like, you are so weird. Totally. And for that class, I had a lap harp. And because I didn't have a lyre at the time or anything like that, there were no makers of those who made it for like the public or anything like that. That was only very recent, like 7 years ago, mm-hmm. or six, maybe even 6 years ago, when wow. the Theodos music instrument started making it for the public. So anyway, you know, so I just took up my lap harp and I just demonstrating like, here's a lap harp. It's different from a lyre. And I'm explaining why. And I played a couple songs on it and they're like, okay, that's cool. And then one of the other professors, Andromachie Karanika, who is now editor of a major journal and who's still there and who's now my mentor, had overheard. She's walking down the hall and she heard it and she's like, well, that's lovely. Can you play for my class, my undergrad class? You know, so sure, you know, and we maintained contact and she's been fabulous. She's worked on things with, you know, women, women and song, basically women at work. Mm. What are they singing? Things like that. And if it weren't for her, I wouldn't have thought about the connection between Penelope working on her weaving and singing at the same time. And it was mm-hmm. like the first major song that I had done by myself. And the first song that I'd done was the Epitaph of Siculus with Michael Levy. And it's funny how I approach people. I just look at the stuff, look at their music, email them and go, wow, you know, I love that. Can I work with you? And that, I think that seems very like a weird approach to most people. Like, why would you think that somebody would listen to you? I go, I don't know. I just do. But they do.
Well, yeah. I mean, you have to try, right?
You have to try. Yeah.
Yeah.
You have to show what you got. So I'm like, oh, I've sung like this song. Here's a quick recording. What do you think of that? And he was like, wow, that would sound really good together. So he took his lyre music and my, you know, my song, my singing, because he had just been doing lyre music, but no actual mm-hmm. lyrics. And so that's the oldest complete song that has musical notations. It's an ancient Greek song. And then, it's got musical notations. And, you know, we put it together and it became a big hit, I guess, for the ancient world. People, you know, as far as like
classics, world, big hits go.
There you go. Yes, that's right.
Which are very important. Absolutely.
Of course.
And, all I care about.
you know, I mean, I went into grad school thinking this is great stuff. And nobody knew anything about ancient music at the time. There was Stefan Hagel. There was a recording of Stefan Hagel, I remember, who is now my friend. But like back then, it was just like a name. Who is this mysterious person singing Demodocus' song? And he only played like four notes over and over again. Now, of course, he says, oh, well, we were naive back then. It was a long time ago. I said, yeah, our knowledge of ancient Greek music has expanded so much just in the past 15 years since I like left grad school. So at the time, it wasn't really doing much for me, honestly. And when it came time towards the end, when I was taking my exams already, what was really getting me was like the mythology at the time. And that was making me excited. And I was like, I want to sing these songs. I was singing Homer and like, nobody can help me with this. And at the time I already started a family. So, you know, by that point in time, you could already see the trend was not very good with academic hiring and me with starting a family. It seemed the best thing to do would be to teach high school Latin because I had grown to love Latin at that point. I also was, you know, loved ancient Greek, but ancient Greek is not being hired in most, you know, classes.
Latin. Yeah. Latin is hard to find teacher, like the, you know, places that'll actually teach it. Like, you know, I certainly in high school, there was no option for anything like that.
Yeah, it's rare, right? But apparently there were places in California. It seemed the best thing for me to do instead of taking this child and putting him around trying to find a job in various states, right? Begging for a job to just take a job in California as a public high school teacher, take my credential work and all that, and settle down, enjoy summers and Thanksgivings and Christmases with my baby. And, you know, it became a thing and I settled in, but I never stopped playing music or teaching music and reading. And to me, music and myth always went together because I think I always thought of the bard Homer, who was a total fanficker, you know. This is just my view. So this is not anything that I've read, but I really feel that Homer didn't like the Olympians. Like, he, whatever gods he worshipped, Maybe they were the Titans. Maybe he just didn't. But he clearly didn't like them. And he was the relationships that he was showing us was that the gods were petty and so on. Those were not in the Homeric hymns, called Homeric, not because he wrote them, right? And they were not in the Orphic hymns either. So, you know, who wrote them? It's oral tradition that has the name Homer to it, whether he was the editor, the person, the school, who knows, right? What is Homer? But we'll just call him Homer just to make it
easy. It's easier.
It's easier, you know. Yeah. Demodocus was in there someplace too. Was he real? Was he not? Who knows? Yeah. But so there's that oral tradition of a bunch of bards singing a bunch of songs. And this collection, the one that's known as the Iliad, has these gods that are just like powerful but petty.
I see. It's interesting. Like I mean, that's the pettiness of the gods is why I love it. I almost
it's fun.
Think it is like, it's so fun.
Fun,
I mean, that's
totally.
Like why I'm here. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But what I love is to think about, like, it's not necessarily that, you know, Homer, whoever they may be, you know, disliked the Olympians so much as I take it as like really understanding the way they would have been seen back then, which is just like deeply human, like pulling the strings in this deeply human and flawed and obnoxious and weird way. Like, I love the Olympians versus, you know, modern deities, like, Christian ideals, because they're so much more human in this really accessible and entertaining way, you know? Because you're right. Like, the gods in the Iliad are so over the top in a way that I find so deeply entertaining. And, like, a little bit less so, I guess, in the Odyssey. Like, they're there, but, yeah, they're not petty, bitchy little children in the same way that they are in the Iliad.
Yeah, Iliad is so much more fun because you sit there and you go, okay, now if I were a god and I had that much power, would I do that? Yeah, I would. Yeah, sure I would. I'd behave that way.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what I mean. It's like he didn't like them in the sense like he was not a worshiper of them, I should just say.
Well, but maybe the worshiping was still just appreciating that they were like that, you know? Like, you could worship them and also be like, man, you're petty motherfuckers, but like, I worship you anyway.
I see what you're saying.
And, you know, I mean, and who knows? I just find it all entertaining to think like that. But then, you know, if you think about the Homeric hymns too, like the Hermes hymn.
Oh, hymn
is a pretty
Hermes.
Good example.
Love that. Love that. Yeah.
It's because it's so good. It's so ridiculous. Like, that's a pretty good example of similarly ridiculous gods, granted in different ways and like not interacting with humans in the same way.
Yeah.
But like, I mean, he invents the lyre, gives it up just by like stumbling upon a turtle that. Poor turtle, you know?
Tortoise.
A tortoise, yeah.
Yeah. This one is a replica. I have one in a box that's actual tortoise shell. And so this is the Barbitos. Barbiton.
Wow. Yeah.
This is the Sappho.
Oh, right,
Barbitos,
yeah.
Right? So this is the one that she had played. And I always wondered if one of the Homers, one of the bards, was ever a female bard, but there's unfortunately no evidence that there was ever a female bard. And I need to look that up, and that's one of my research goals. For me, when I say a bard, it's someone who travels and sings stories, sings the myths to various, whereas Sappho seemed to really enjoy a particular place, right, where she is in her island of Lesbos, and she's well known. I mean, she is like the best singer and composer of poetry, a poet and singer of it, and lyrist, lyre player, all in one. And they come to see her, and she performs, and she wins. So she does not travel. I guess to me,
that's true.
When I think of the bard, I think of this guy like going around and in a place, and maybe that's why there weren't women, because goodness knows they were.
It wouldn't have been that easy to travel around.
Not so very much, right? Unsafe conditions, traveling to place, and singing your songs and singing it to different people with various values. So you go somewhere and you, and Helen, right? Helen never has a description in the Iliad. You never hear it. She does not have blonde hair, dark hair, anything, because she's just the most beautiful woman. But that makes sense, because a bard going to a strange new location says, I will sing you a song about the most beautiful woman who caused a war. Oh, yes. What did she look like? He looks at the queen and says, she looked like you, queen. Just like you. Yeah. Right?
Divine. That's so like interesting. You. It's so funny. Okay. So one of the last people I recorded with earlier this week, we talked about Helen and the, you know, the beautiful evil, the Calon Cacon, and how she's not described.
She's
and
not
how
described.
Interesting it is that she's not described. But and then you have this whole other reason that so makes so much sense. Like, of course, yeah, it's not necessarily some sort of commentary on beauty so much as it is an easy way to make sure that you're also complimenting the people who you're singing for. And that's so
right.
interesting.
And yeah. even the goddesses, you know, you get well-tressed mm-hmm. goddess, but yeah. not like skin color. You do get you know, owl-eyed Athena, mm-hmm. and and maybe even gray-eyed Athena, mm-hmm. so you get that. But you know, you kind of wonder, is it because the gray eyes in general, you're thinking sky, you're thinking that just seems to be a logical color for mm-hmm. someone with wisdom or you know, something like that.
Yeah.
But no other descriptions of the other ones. And even Aphrodite, right? Aphrodite, mm-hmm. Aphrodita, so on. She has no description. I mean, the most beautiful goddess. What was the hair color? What was her skin color? What was, yeah. you know, nothing.
There are some references to blonde, isn't there? Not necessarily in Homer, but elsewhere, right? right?
Elsewhere.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm. yeah, but not Homer.
Mm-hmm. Even among my Greek friends, I had a Greek professor who said insistently that she had to have been blonde. I forgot why she had that idea. But mm-hmm. then there's Achilles, you know, lion-maned Achilles, and various translators would say, mm-hmm. "Oh no, it's describing a lion's hair, the way it's wild, or something more than the color." But you ask a Greek, and they would say, "Well, Menelaus had blonde hair, you know, he was Xanthis." And I have friends with their last name Xanthoulis and Xanthous and so on, and it's, you know, it means blonde to them. And mm-hmm. both of my friends happen to be blondish blonde. And, you know, so they're saying like, that is the color. That is what they mm-hmm. consider the color. And I do understand. I listen to the people of the land. Like, so among my Greek friends, what is the meaning to you? Rather than, you know, I hate to say it, but like someone else, a British or American who might be projecting their ideas onto the culture. Mm-hmm. You have to listen to both.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then you also have to take into consideration too, that like modern Greek, while 100% valid, is also, you know, 2,700 years later.
Yeah.
And
yes.
so it has their own influences of so many millennia of change and everything. And how have they been influenced by that? And then
exactly,
that gets
right?
affected as well. Yeah. And when I was there, it was really interesting, like, you know, the things that they would tell me versus what I know. It was interesting. I mean, it's, yeah.
And what is
so
the meaning
there.
To them? I mean, what is mm-hmm. their reception of mm-hmm. it, right? Always there's that balance of that's fine. We can be all academic about it. Mm-hmm. And we you know, this is our meaning of it. But when you mm-hmm. take it back to the people of that land, what meaning is it to you these days in your modern world?
Mm-hmm.
And
it, generationally, it's very different too. Of
yeah,
like the age
yeah.
of the Greek person, I learned.
Oh,
you know,
yes,
like
yeah.
I was speaking to people, you know, in their early 30s, late 20s, and their viewpoint was very different than a couple of people who would speak to me, you know, who were
sure.
boomers when like and then in the in between, and yeah, it's just sort of very fascinating sort of taking that in and learning from everybody. Yeah
I love traveling and hearing the various folk tradition myths and music, of course, always music and what it all means, mm-hmm. and how they're putting myths in their music these days. I mean, that's been a thing. So there's always been, or I should say always, like for generations, in the summers, there's plays in Greece, always of the ancient Greek tragedies. And they had performed them with choruses, singing and dancing. And to various other Europeans or even Americans, they're like, oh, this is a new thing we're doing. And I'm thinking it's not new to them. It's that they've been doing it for years and years. It's just you haven't been paying attention to what the Greeks were doing until now. So, sorry, I'm very Greek focused, just because I was thinking that you've been in Greece and
recently. It's interesting. Yeah, I did watch they live streamed a performance of the frogs at Epidaurus.
Yeah,
and that was, I watched that and sort of. It did have subtitles, which was nice, but I was also trying to take in the Greek as well, since I'm trying to learn Greek. And it was really interesting watching the interpretation of that. And it was a beautiful performance of it. It was very cool.
But it just reminds you that in any of the bards, you know, they're singing from place to place, they had to be very aware of who they were singing to. Mm-hmm. So one of the more controversial aspects of the Iliad is Achilles and Patroclus. Mm-hmm. What was their relationship? And Joel Christensen had said, I forgot where, but he's offered this thought before, that it's simply that for each space, there were different, you know, attitudes towards love. And so it was hard to say, you know, I guess where it was acceptable to say Achilles and Patroclus had this sort of love or that sort of love. And so it was purposely vague in the Iliad. And so, you know, There are passages where you're so certain it's a love, the kind that the romantic, absolutely, because why else would you want to be to have your ashes buried in the same, you know, like, oh, who would do that? And yet, you know, in one of the other scenes, Achilles and Patroclus are separately sleeping with two enslaved women, you know, and never together, and it never shows them embrace passionately in a kiss or anything like that. And yet again, back to, well, why would you have your ashes mixed together, you know?
And like Achilles's reaction to the death,
yes,
is, you know,
right?
Is over the top, even for, you know, the closest friend. He loses his mind. It's really fascinating to, I mean, I think that's such a interesting and, you know, very appropriate interpretation of it. It sort of fits just for now, even, right? Like the amount that people will interpret it and how everyone sees it and the way that translation affects it and all those different things. It is so interesting.
Yeah. But that's why I love both the Song of Achilles by Madeline Miller as well as the movie Troy. And people will be like, I hate the movie Troy. Like, I love the movie Troy. How can I love both these things at the same time? Because I, like most people, I pick and choose which parts I'm looking at.
Yeah.
And loving. So
I enjoy most of Troy, I will clarify. I like most of it. I think, you know, there's certain things where, but otherwise, like, I'm with you. I mean, I'll certainly enjoy watching Brad Pitt in Troy.
There you are.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah. Or, you know, the actor who, for Hector, oh, him.
Oh my God, Eric Bana as Hector.
Eric Bana. And Sean Bean, come on. Lost opportunity. Not to have the Odyssey.
The Odyssey with Sean Bean
would have been epic. Epic. Wonderful.
Like, there's nothing that I want more in the world than that.
Oh, I was excited. I was like, it's Sean Bean. It's 007. 006. 006.
Yeah.
Right?
Bad guy.
He always plays that ambiguous or ambiguous bad guy or the one that's complicated.
Boromir.
Always the one that's like, you're all, okay, I love you, but like, I hate you, but I love you. And
feeling. No, it would have been perfect. Agreed.
The only time I ever liked Odysseus was as Sean Bean. I'm like,
I love Odysseus. He is my problematic fave. as they
say. Oh my god. Well, if I see Sean Bean as Odysseus, I can forgive Odysseus. Otherwise, yeah. I hate Odysseus. Every moment of the Odyssey, I'm just like, why? Oh,
I love him. I love him so much.
And then I picture Sean Bean. I'm like, oh, yeah, never mind, honey. No, it's okay. You be okay. You.
You can do anything.
You be you now. I forgive you. Yeah. So with the Song of Achilles, Madeline had asked for me to introduce her, and so I had proposed a song. At the time, I was still playing with the title, and I called it. I might have called it Achilles, Briseis, and Patroclus or something. At this point in time, I'm calling it Achilles, Patroclus, and Briseis in the order. And I had started with Achilles. I knew I had to pick and choose passages and still make it dactylic hexameter. That was one heck of a
something.
Yeah, it was. It really was. And I wanted specifically that it's Achilles calling Patroclus's name. That had to be the beginning. And the ending had to be Patroclus saying Achilles's name. I'm like, okay, all right, good. What else do I need in there? I need Briseis in there as well. And it has to be clear in this song that it's a love song. So, you know, which lines do I pick and choose from? But I found it. It started with Achilles calling out to Patroclus when Patroclus had died. And then Patroclus's ghost coming and saying, lay not your bones from me, Achilles. Let them be together just as when we were growing up. Let them be together. And then Achilles saying, Patroclus, stay, you know, stay. Don't go yet, just for a little bit. And it's just like, so I chose the most heart-wrenching moment. And then I interspersed Briseis's voice, which is actually from another book, when she wails. When she first sees Patroclus dead, and she wails and she says, "Patroclus, you're the best, you know." And then she's just wailing, and then back to Patroclus. The very last thing is, you know, lay not your bones from me, far from me, Achilles. Mm. And that's how I ended it. And you know, to me, that captures that complication of all that, where Briseis is in there in the Song of Achilles by Madeline Miller. Briseis was in love with Patroclus, which explains like that weird passage. Where'd that come from? But one of the things that I had noted in that passage of Briseis wailing is that she had said something interesting. It is that she was comforted by Patroclus when Achilles had taken her, by the idea that Achilles was taking her as his wife. That she would have an actual marriage to Achilles. And that comforted her, because socially she would have been just thrown away. Like, so her status was not just going to be as an enslaved person, but rather someone who was going to be a princess somewhere else. So yes, she lost her loved ones, and it's horrible, but at least he's trying to give her but at least you're not going to be an enslaved person. You're going to be a princess in this land. And that was his comforting thought to her. You will be protected. You will not be endangered. But with Patroclus dead and Achilles staying to fight and him dying, that's no longer going to be her fate. Her fate is just to die as an enslaved person. Patroclus can't help her anymore and promote that idea to Achilles. So it's like there's that too. Yes, that aside from the fact that maybe she had a crush on Patroclus or whatever, it's the fact that he was offering to her this small comfort, you know, after such a horrid fate.
Yeah, which is, I mean, that's the thing I think, that's the thing I'm more conscious of these days is just paying attention to the story of Briseis and like how I interpret her, because, you know, a lot of like, that's my issue with Troy, I would say. Like, it certainly wasn't back in the day, but then now the more I watch it, I'm just like, the depiction of Briseis and Achilles is like a little when you think about the fact that she is a completely an abused and horrifically abused enslaved person, you know. But that and I think that the other, you know, just Patroclus in general, he seems to come across as that little bit of kindness amongst the rest of the Greeks too, right? He's sort of inherently the nicest of them, he's the best of them, he's the sort of redeeming nature of the Greeks. And so you can kind of see an attachment that would form there regardless of all of the other things, just because she has this one person who isn't as horrible to her as everybody else, you know?
And that's it. And a small comfort. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Right. And you would hang on to that small comfort. And then when he's mm-hmm. gone, you know, yeah, there's so many little bits and pieces that can really make you get to the point of why Briseis would have been upset with his death. Is, you know, there's so many little things that he represented to her,
and it's so complicated too, though, right? Because mm-hmm. because Patroclus himself killed people. I mean, he was a soldier.
Yeah, he wasn't so flawless.
It's like he was the nicest of these killers, right?
Yep.
But of course you could see a soldier on the other hand as someone who is a protector. As if you're on that side, mm-hmm. Hector is your protector. He's slaughtering people, but hey, he's protecting you, so it's okay that he's killing people. So mm-hmm. it's really depending on which side, which perspective you're looking at.
Mm-hmm.
So. Why do I love Achilles? It's because I see him as Thetis' son. That's the main thing. When I first read the Iliad, you know, because we had to read it in ancient Greek as opposed to here's the English version. Mm-hmm. And I think I was trying to understand why I should care. Mm-hmm. And so I read The Power of Thetis by Laura Slatkin, who's a dear friend and mentor to me now. And it was incredible. It was an incredibly moving thing. So imagine that this is my first introduction to it, you know, rather than any other way, not as Achilles the Glorious, whatever, but as Thetis' son. And I think it always just sort of fixed itself in my brain like that, where mm-hmm. her central question was, why is the hero of the Iliad the son of Thetis, as opposed to, mm-hmm. you know, the son of Zeus? Why?
You also have the interesting, you know, the idea that Thetis was meant, or that Zeus, like, stopped her from marrying anyone powerful because her son was supposed to be greater than him.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. That's, right? That's why that book is the Power of Thetis. Like, what did she mean? And in various, if you look at her name, Thetis, it's related to tithemi, which is to place. And so they think that she's really one of the creator gods.
Mm.
And so she had that power, you know, before they formed the whole Olympian framework, right? Mm-hmm. That she was one of the goddesses that actually had extreme power like that. And so when they wove her into the to their myths, into the Olympian myths, they still couldn't get rid of the fact that she had this sort of innate power. Mm-hmm. Whatever she had, it's huge. So, you know, in that awful myth where she was forced by the gods, really, it was their ideas, mm-hmm. that a mortal should force her down and impregnate mm-hmm. her and then make him his own. In a very brutal way, right? That's how she would then be forced to have this half mortal child. Mm-hmm. And I wrote this poem that is all about I called it the lullaby of Thetis, and it's all about her goodbye to Achilles. He's dead, and so she starts by saying, "What wrath should I sing? Should I start with this, you know, your origins, which is this? Should I start with that? Should I be angry about that?" So it's already like a complicated place where, you know, I love you, son, but I was forced to have you. And I never had a choice about you becoming you. But you had your choices of which path to take, because he did. He could have chosen to die as a hero in this war, or to live a long life back in his native land with, and to live. But then once he has died, he'll be remembered for a generation maybe, or the next one, and then not anymore after that. Whereas mm-hmm. he will be remembered forever as a hero of this one war. And he chooses, of course, the hero's path. And Thetis doesn't stop him. you know, she did try. And I did put that in my poem. That's going to be in this one anthology, by the way. I'm very excited about that.
Great. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Anyway, I'm very grateful that they took it, because it's like the one poem in this like anthology of like academic writing. And they're including that in there. I footnoted it, but still it's like, well, thank you for taking my poem.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't steer away from the part where she does take Achilles and try to stick him on an island. Right? Yeah. The island of women.
She does her best, yeah.
She does do that. But like after her first thwarted attempt, she's like, okay, you know, that was it. That was my last attempt. And then she like gives him blankets. Like there's this scene in the Iliad where he's unpacking stuff. He's looking for something. And he takes out the blankets that she had given him from Thetis. Like, how cute is that? It's like, you know.
Your mom's sending you to war with blankets.
Yeah, the blankets and the cup for to send libations to Zeus. It's like she's like, no, don't forget the other gods that you have to give libations to, you know. So here's a cup for Zeus. It's like, what a good mommy.
Yeah.
So I guess and you know, and that famous scene where he's sitting there at the shore, and I know lots of people see it as he's sulking there. But instead of seeing him as sulking there, I think of him as praying to his mother. He sits and in his moment of great consternation. And I think I am immature enough to actually see myself in that moment where if somebody had dishonored me in some way, I would be just absolutely pissed off. I would be. And I can't, so that's why I think I felt for him too. I'm like, oh, well, okay, let's just say, I mean, it's horrible that it's like it happens. It's an enslaved woman. That's his object. Okay, that sucks.
That's the thing that makes it hard. But if you ignore that part, yeah, it's easy to get to the I'm pissed off
because they're taking away his honor. Like that's the part that's in his mind it's an honor. It's a sense of honor, right? Mm-hmm. So I guess that's what struck at me is like they are taking away this thing to him that represents honor. Okay, later he also says in the book, which makes things complicated, he uses the word love or fond of many times in this one scene describing Briseis. And again, which bard had put that in there, which oral tradition had decided that he did love Briseis, but he said it a few times, like, I love her, she's my bedmate, might even have been my wife, like, I'd have to take a look at it, but it was definitely like, it kept saying, I'm fond of her, I love her, you know, and this, and they're taking her from me. So putting that aside as like, well, okay, fine, even if I'm not looking at that, because that doesn't seem to be that theme doesn't seem to be shown except for that one time. Like, never have I ever seen him say over and over, and I love her, and they took her, except for that one scene. Okay, so I'll have to kind of say, okay, so it's not that. It's the honor part of that. Okay. I really could sit there and go, they took your honor. Everybody else had their stuff not taken away. Why that thing? Okay. So honor stripped from him. He prays to his mother, like his mother / goddess.
We went from normal life, healthy child to acute lymphoblastic leukemia or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Are you tired of your scented cleaning products smelling and cleaning like meh? Then it's time for an upgrade, with the power of Clorox Scentiva. With an uplifting scent that smells like coconut, Clorox Scentiva gives you powerful clean like Clorox, but a feeling like being transported to a tropical island retreat. Imagine putting your phone on Do Not Disturb, tuning out all the constant, just the feeling of warm sand in between your toes and a fruity drink in your hand. The ones with the little umbrella. Refresh your home to feel like an all-inclusive vacation by getting Clorox Scentiva. Also available in grapefruit and lavender scents at a nearby retail store.
He prays to his mother, like his mother slash goddess. And that's interesting because, I mean, that's such a particular thing, right? His mother, whom he honors, but also his goddess. That's mm-hmm. who he prays to. When you need somebody, you pray to your god. He prays to his mother mm-hmm. slash goddess. And he knows it's going to be fulfilled. And she comes and she's tender. She holds his hand. You know, she comes from anywhere. Right from the bottom of the sea, while she's hanging out with her father, she hears him. It's like you know, you have your iPhone on you, and it's beeping. You know, phone call is happening, or your watch, your iWatch is going off, and you're like, oh, gotta go, and she goes, and then she comes up and she holds his hand, and then she says, and he reminds her, you know, that Zeus. You had that power over Zeus. You were the only one who were able to unchain him that one mm-hmm. time when the gods had rebelled against him, mm-hmm. which is a very interesting moment.
I love that one.
In myth, right? Ooh. Like, yeah. You were so powerful that you were able to do this. And why? Mm-hmm. And it makes you wonder, why would you do it anyway? Because mm-hmm. this is the same god, or maybe mm-hmm. that was before. Maybe... That was before she was forced.
Yeah. Or maybe she just realized, too, that, like, this will get me something important later.
Maybe so.
You but know?
In the timeline of when did Zeus force her to marry a human, that was before, right? That was before that happened. So she and Zeus were still not frenemies. They're still, like, you know.
Yeah, they were sort of. Just, you know, he was just there.
Yeah, they must have had some sort of relationship, friendship, something, right, for her to mm-hmm. care. And she does that. And for whatever reasons it was, but later she's able to hold it to him and say, mm-hmm. here it is. Okay, she does do the supplication thing mm-hmm. Where she kneels and she holds his chin. Mm-hmm. And she is a suppliant. And she asks for this one thing, which is that the tide of the battle won't turn until Achilles comes back. Mm-hmm. And the odd and interesting and phenomenal thing is that the gods didn't get in the way of that. Zeus said, okay. And nobody mm-hmm. questioned it. They're like, whoa, mm-hmm. that is asked.
Yeah.
And this is going to happen. What a moment, right?
That is so interesting. I hadn't thought all that much about it. It's so fascinating, but it also reminds me that it's quite interesting in general that Achilles, with the power that he has, you know, the importance of him, that his divinity comes from his mother.
Yes.
Because all other heroes, other than Aeneas, which I've also commented in previous conversations uh-huh. about how interesting it is that Aeneas has the same.
Yeah.
You know, that like, yeah, that the god in the family is his mom. And that's so rare, just because, you know, 9 times out of 10 your dad is Zeus.
Oh gosh, when I get started on the Aeneid, same. I only care about Aeneas because it's Aphrodite's son.
Yeah, I know. And well, and I do think I find the Aeneas interesting, or the Aeneid interesting, not necessarily for the work itself, in which I often find it a little bit boring. But just the fact that they picked Aeneas to be this founder of Rome mythologically, like out of everybody in the Iliad, but then on top of that, like the Iliad singles him out in a really interesting way if you remind yourself that the Iliad did not see him as a founder of Rome. You know, like whoever Homer is did not see Aeneas going on to found Rome, but they still made him this very unique character in the Iliad, like to explicitly have Aphrodite as his mother is rare. To have her save him from the battlefield in such like an iconic and momentous way that injures her in the process. Like everything about Aeneas, it kind of connects him to Achilles in the Iliad, in like as like the Trojan Achilles kind of, you know, in a way that then having him like much later go on to be this founder of Rome is just so fascinating because what was Homer thinking coming up with Aeneas? You know, that's my question. It's like, what was his intention? Because it certainly wasn't to have him go found Rome.
Right.
You know? So like, what was his purpose?
And how exactly sexy was Anchises? Apparently quite so.
Well, I mean, but Zeus made her do that, right? Like that was all on Zeus.
That was, in the Homeric hymn to Aphrodite.
To Aphrodite, yeah.
Six? Was it six? Yeah.
It's the long one that we that's all I know.
She goes over there and she tells an elaborate tale to Anchises.
Oh my god.
Right?
Yeah. It's very like, Odysseus.
Yeah,
very
right. Odysseus, and I'm just this girl. And then, you know, just hanging out.
But let me tell you literally every detail about my fake life.
Yeah,
like,
right.
You don't need to know.
Yeah. But I am the perfect bride for you, you see. Mm-hmm. So come take me. And you know, and if it's Zeus that made her do it, what was he thinking, you know, to do that?
I forget if it's explicit in the hymn or if it's elsewhere, but wasn't it that she was like the only goddess to have never been with a human, or there was something about it where she had never been with a human and he was trying to like bring her down?
You know, I don't remember the funny thing is I remember tweeting about it, but I don't remember that first part because I just zoomed in on like, hey, what's Aphrodite, like all this, you know, funny business that you're saying, why not just kind of be like, hey, I'm Aphrodite, I'm beautiful, come on.
Yeah.
No, she wanted to be liked for herself or her fake self or.
Yeah.
Right.
It's
a very interesting.
Yeah, and she like prepares herself in this really intricate way and has the, you know, the Horai, like she has them like prepare her in, you know, all of her beauty and like make her it, you
like
know,
like
look
bridal
her best and smell
like
her an, best and all of these things.
Sure, like in a very bridal way, right? So it's cool because in those hymns you get to see like what are bridal preparations like and what kind of clothes were they wearing and all that. So I love looking at that. And I think that's what that's what my focus was on that day. And I was like, wow, okay. And then she's like, okay, I don't really have time to be a mother though. So, you know, they'll watch him for 5 years and then they'll bring him to you and then you raise him. And
yeah, like, and I'm done. I won't see him again until I save him from a war.
Yeah. So all that was, it's hard to say which was before the oral traditions in Iliad or the Homeric hymn, or were they happening at the same time? So, you know, I'm bringing that up because I'm thinking the two were somehow connected so that you couldn't get rid of the idea of Anchises, Aphrodite, and Aeneas. And somehow they were in this war. For whatever reason. And then Virgil picks that up later going, now that's got possibilities. It's got lots of possibilities. Let's go with that.
Yeah.
I love Aphrodite so very much. She's just.
Me too. Yeah. She's like how
she's
I
scary.
Got into mythology. She is scary, but she also, for me, what I love. Oh yeah, absolutely. She was number one.
Oh, tell me.
Like when I was a kid.
What was your first? Yeah.
I wish I remembered enough. I don't have a great memory of what exactly got me in. I just know that it was Aphrodite as like Aphrodite in general. She's just wonderful.
With Aphrodite, I think probably my first exposure to her was the Botticelli Venus. And I was raised in the Philippines till I was like 8.5 years old. And so, you know, red-haired people, blonde people, we do get them because we're such a mixed people. We have Europeans in my family. If an alien ever wanted to land and get like a population sample, just come to my family, and we have all the various continents in our, you know, in my genetics. But it's still like, I remember when I was in elementary school, you know, we had some blonde kids and we had some redhead kids, but it's still like rare, you know, within mm-hmm. a population. Most of us just have brown hair. We can be pale, we can be dark, we can be my color, but still like red hair. Ooh, that's interesting. So yeah. The Botticelli Venus image always like struck me as, okay, that's interesting. I'm not sure I saw her as more beautiful or anything, but just like, oh, that's what beautiful looks like to them, I guess is what I was thinking. Like, okay, that's okay. All right. On a shell though, what's up with a shell? And then that actually got me curious, like a shell, why a shell?
What's up with that shell?
Yeah. What's going on? Then I started, you know, looking at the two myths of her, and the Iliad one just makes her Zeus's daughter.
Yeah, I don't like that.
No, me neither.
I don't go
neither.
With that one. That's no fun.
No, that is not fun. The Theogony, no. The Hesiod weird.
That's the fun.
Weird SH star T thing. Ooh, yeah, that. Hesiod was all sorts of fun, weird.
I call her stuff. She of the castration foam.
There
that's
you are.
My name for the podcast.
Oh my gosh.
To
you
the
know,
point where people quote it to me quite mm-hmm, often mm-hmm. with like even TM at the end.
Yes.
Like, this is, I love that I've inflicted this upon a population of young people. Like Aphrodite, she of the castration foam.
Pontos plus Uranus equals Aphrodite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I point that out to my students. Poor students, but you know, they get this myth. I'm like, I'm gonna tell you, miss, have a drink of water first before we listen to this strange myth. And you know, I said it's a very like here's the ocean, but he's called Pontos, at least in that myth. I know there's someone had pointed out that in another one, in the Orphic myth, it's another ocean, but in this one, in Theogony, it's Pontos. So in this one, which I enjoy, it's like it's a male being, masculine being, plus a very masculine Uranus equals a hyper feminine, you know. Oh, and then she hangs out with Himeros and Eros on that island. I love that. I'm like, oh, and what do they do? What do these three love gods do? On this, you know, and it's so cool because it's like Aphrodite's born and Aristarchus like, hey, Himeros, check her out. Let's go and hang out with her. And then that's like end of story with that.
Yeah.
You know, and then she goes to, then when she goes to Kythera and so on, it's like from Kypros, she goes to Kythera. But it's like, but first when she's there, the other love gods are hanging with her. And I'm always like, oh, I want to know the fanfic that goes on there. Like what's happening?
Especially if you make Eros not her son in that case.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Because in Theogony, he's supreme chaos, being of love, right?
Chaos,
he's
yeah.
Until he's born, no procreation happens. If you noticed, so that always struck me too. Like okay, and Eros is called the most beautiful god in Hesiod's Theogony, which is a very wonderful, interesting set of myths.
There's a lot. I read from Theogony a lot. I really enjoy so much of it, and then
so enjoyable, so fun.
It really is. It's so wonderful. But then sometimes, like I covered Pandora earlier, and it's so interesting when you go from like just the general Theogony, you know, creation of everything, and then you get to the creation of Pandora, and you're getting like some ideas, I think, about how Hesiod saw women. And then you read the Pandora from Works and Days,
yes,
and you're like, ah,
right.
Okay, this is how Hesiod saw women, and it's not good.
Yeah, right. At that point, you're all, oh, do I need to reread everything else then?
Exactly.
But you know, you wonder which parts are made by him and which parts were oral tradition and which parts because of course the creation things, stories like that, they echo other traditions, which is why it seems so similar to the beginning creation, the Bible story, right? Because it's coming from the same place somehow. When things are created, you know, and love is in there, Aphrodite is always so scary when she sends in, when Eros slash Cupid is later seen as her son for whatever reason, right? Someone decided that Eros can't just be himself doing his own thing.
See, for me, I see it as, like, I appreciate the two different variations, but I see it more as when they wanted to start making stories where Eros is like, you know, silly and like kind of a troublemaker and he's causing trouble, then they had to make him more of a traditional god. Like, they had to make him the son of an Olympian instead of this, like, primordial superhuman being, because I think the Eros that springs from chaos is too like impressive and powerful and primordial to then be associated with, you know, shooting Apollo or Daphne with an arrow, you know, like it's almost too human for a god like that. Like, they don't have the primordial beings doing much in the way of troublemaking, of like causing grief. So I feel like they had to make him much more accessible and like human in a way that, you know, he's still a god, but that's how he's more of a child of an Olympian, a Hermes style, versus, you know, like prime. It's like seeing Gaia doing something silly like that versus, you know, Hermes.
Yeah, I agree with you on Eros slash Cupid is much more accessible and easily written into stories than this scary love god, right?
Yeah,
who comes out of nowhere? Like, so, chaos is somehow happens. Gaia somehow happens. Eros somehow happens. Tartarus somehow happens inside Gaia, but she doesn't create Tartarus. It's like these first four were created out of nowhere. Like, they're just,
well, to me, it's like the Big Bang.
Yeah.
You know, boom, it's boom, very, boom, right? Yeah. It's very like, okay, it's like, you know,
whatever chaos is,
what we believe now.
Yeah. Everything or nothing. Yeah. Gaia, which is a nurturing body, something that can later house so many things. Tartarus, by the way, Tartarus is just a weird thing. Like, I'm just like,
oh, I call it an, like, all the parts of a noun, like a person, place, and a thing. Tartarus
inside Gaia
is like, all of it.
Yeah. And it's just like inside her, just like, okay, whatever, like, she's just like, whoa, all right, what is that? And then you know, Eros as a just a supreme force, a power, a feeling that moves us so much, and it's unexplainable, happens before the concept of death, before the concept of fate is, at least in the story.
I'm always so interested. I don't know enough about Orphic mythology, but I don't know how much I want to ask, because I feel like there's so much. I don't know anything about Orphic mythology, I should say, except for like a certain handful of the gods that are only, or not necessarily like even a handful, but like the certain people that are only in Orphic mythology, because people will ask about them, and I'm just kind of like, I'm gonna back right off. Like, I don't want to talk about Zagreus. I don't know.
Right. I keep looking at that, going, okay, I need to look up these gods and see where else they show up. Yeah, there are like four or five that so far, you know, are so uncommon that like they don't appear anywhere else, it seems, except in Orphic myth. But yeah, hands off Zagreus for a bit there. And
yeah, anything Orphic. I'm like, it feels like it's too daunting. I don't know where I haven't bought a single book on Orphic. I keep, you know, it's like on the end of my list of things I'll get to eventually.
I have to say that the Iliad versions of Athena and the Odyssey versions of Athena, I never liked. And especially I didn't like any Ovid Athena. I'm like,
yeah, Ovid Athena is problematic.
What in the world? So I never really understood, like, why, or even, you know, the place, right? The place about her. I'm like, you guys don't worship Athena clearly, because you make her sound like an awful being, unless this is how you choose to, like, this is how she's worshipped. She's really an awful, a dread goddess of some sort. I mean, I don't understand. But when I read the Orphic hymns versions of Athena, I'm like, oh, the wise goddess. Okay, so that's how you view her. Like, all right, not the awful goddess who does this and that, but also this. You know, I started seeing her that way. Like, okay, that's how she was worshipped. I see. So I could venerate a goddess who's like wise, and I guess the her springing from the head of Zeus thing and her being Zeus's pet daughter just always bugged, even, you know, from Theogony.
Oh yeah, I mean, I always see her as like, I mean, I love her. I love Athena, but I see her as the man's goddess. Like, she's the one who has, you know, a lot of traditionally masculine characteristics. She always sides with the men. She always sides with the heroes. Like, she seems like the goddess that the men developed to have a woman in the room, but who they could associate with all of their varied, like, you know, hyper masculine, important, like, you know, quote unquote important qualities, all these things. So yeah, she seems to me like a goddess developed by men versus a goddess developed by like the culture itself.
Right. But there, I do think this part was interesting reading the Theogony or was it from the Theogony? There's this idea that the reason why Zeus had to consume Metis is because Metis's son was going to be more powerful than the sire, kind of like the Thetis idea. Mm-hmm. And so Athena was supposed to be a boy, but somehow was female. So was it like, did a transformation occur inside Zeus? So
yeah, did she like bond with Metis in a different way?
In a way, yeah. Yeah. So that, you know, when she's born, she is wearing armor that you know, traditionally, because they're not thinking Amazons here, they're thinking goes on a Greek warrior. So that's a man's warrior aspect that she's wearing, as if she's supposed to be the son of Zeus, but female. And the fact that she's female makes her not a threat to Zeus.
Yeah.
Just the fact that she's that sex, not male. That little difference, or big difference, is a big difference. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I've only ever considered that myth, or I don't know if it's the translations I've read or what, it's been a long time, but just that it's like Metis's child would be more powerful, but I didn't necessarily read it or find it as explicitly her son. But that makes it very interesting, and sort of to me it really suggests that by eating Metis, Zeus had her like basically form with the sun that was within her and develop Athena kind of based on that. Like, Athena is sort of both, which kind of, you know, lends itself to Athena also being, you know, a goddess who isn't really ever with men or women. She's just, she's, you know,
a unique some being,
would argue asexual. She's a lot kind of going on when it comes to her and her gender, her sexuality, all of that is sort of up for debate in an interesting way. That's very interesting.
Why do you like Athena?
I think I just like that there's a goddess that powerful, you know, that important, that revered, that respected, because they really do in the stories, but also like in the way that she, you know, is the patron goddess of so many cities. Like, they really treated her differently than the other goddesses in a way that I find interesting.
Yeah, wisdom, war, and weaving.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
All that. Mm-hmm. When you think of, oh my gosh, I mean, it's such a rabbit hole. When I think of the various goddesses I adore Leto and her children. Mm-hmm. Hermes. Wow. I mean, Hermes, he has a Rhabdos. He has a Rhabdos like Kirki has a Rhabdos. It's a wand, but it's not a thyrsus. Mm-hmm. It's a Rhabdos. Mm-hmm. But Kirki has the same, it's the same word used for him having this thing as the one that Kirki has, the magic wand that she wields, same word mm-hmm. that he has. He has a Rhabdos.
Interesting.
It is interesting. It's like,
well, especially because, I mean, they're connected in an interesting way of, you know, Hermes kind of rolling up to Odysseus and explicitly telling him how to, you know, basically defeat, not, you know, not officially, but get past Kirki's Circe.
Kirki, please say Kirki.
I know it's accurate. And I say that every time I say her name, I do like clarify, but everyone in English knows her as Circe. So it's just sort of come out that way.
Sure. Yeah.
It's interesting because they are linked in that way of, you know, him rolling up and giving Odysseus moly and being like, this is exactly how to get past her. And,
holy moly, and, Batman. And that, that's where they get it from. It's so funny.
Is that where they get it?
Yeah.
Is that what the word comes from?
Oh, it's a holy moly, right?
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah. My Hermes is so underrated.
I mean, even just this comedic value in the hymn is like...
A little baby child.
Doing everything.
You know? And
he does everything as a baby.
Yeah.
The most ridiculous things. I mean, inventing the lyre as a sort of, it's almost an aside. It's like not even the main point of the story. It's like, oh, you know, he stumbled upon this tortoise and, oh, he figured, hey, like maybe I'll kill it, empty out its body and I'll invent this lyre.
A little baby child.
Yeah. And then he'll go on as a baby and steal the cows and go on this whole like gallivanting journey across Greece. And then, oh my God, I just... absolutely love him. He's so entertaining. And I don't even know. Oh, but the connection with Kirki is very interesting, of them both having the same staff or Rhabdos.
Wand. Rhabdos.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just the connection between them and that. I don't know. It's all, I don't think I had a point with it, but it's fascinating.
It's true. Like if you sit there and think about like, why did he show up? Why did he care? How'd he know how to counteract it? Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And why? And why?
Like why? Yeah.
Like, was it part of his troublemaking nature? If so, there wasn't really any follow-up. Like, he just sort of shows up, helps Odysseus, and then is gone. And then the rest of the storyline.
Like, who sent him?
Odysseus and Kirki. Like, yeah. Yeah.
Usually he's the messenger, but in this case, doesn't seem like anybody sent him. Seemed like it was his idea. Like, why?
Well, and he's so explicitly the messenger elsewhere in the Odyssey, where, you know, he's the one who goes and tells Calypso, like, you have to let him go. Like,
Yeah.
You know, time's up.
As you said.
Do it. But
yeah,
he's explicitly acting in that case as a messenger. But yeah, when it comes to, you know, being on Aiaia and the Moly, it's just like, nah, I'm just here. I think I'm just gonna do this.
I think
like,
that's all in my own will. See, that's why I love Madeline so very much. Because you know, three years ago or whatever, when before Circe, she calls it Circe.
Yeah.
Before Circe became big and I first heard about it, I sent her my song. That's the only one that I did an English version and an ancient Greek. So that one, I took the part where Kirki was saying, you know, why are you so silent, Odysseus, that one. But then with my own poetry, I did like a part two where she's watching him and saying goodbye and stuff. And so, or at least my lyrics, which was based off of like a poem, because you have to take poem, make lyrics different. You know, Madeline, I love her so much because she really researched and thought about these weird things we're talking about. So she made Hermes a lover of Kirki's. Mm-hmm. So that like that explains like why he was hanging around her island. Gosh, wow. I mean, I love rabbit holing about mythology in general. And then, you know, this is just ancient Greek mythology. As you probably know, I also look at ancient Egyptian and But I am such a beginner in ancient Egyptian and any Sumerian myths. Like, absolutely. I have years and years, perhaps a decade or so to catch up. And then anytime people ask me to write a song about something, I will look at the myths first, which might be a strange place to look, but I find that myths tell me a lot about traditions and attitudes of the ancient times. And then to compare it with the attitudes and ideas of people today is always fascinating, you know? Because of course the ancient ones reflect the different times, different population perhaps. And, but even so, even if it's a different population, it's like the people of today still somehow connect to it. Like, what do those myths mean to you? How does it resonate to you, with you? And like, for instance, my latest project is to write three short songs for short films for an excavation project in Sinope in Turkey. I have not researched the myths of that area, but now I'm excited. Like, okay, wow, all right. That's fun. Just, you know, when I was asked to do the American Institute of Archaeology for Honolulu, for Hawaii, lecture on some ancient Egyptian songs, I right away, you know, went into the Book of the Dead. I started there and then kind of went back and read for three straight months on mythology and history and culture of ancient Egypt. Because I, to me, that's how I get into songs. Like, I won't just dive in and just start writing. Like, even if you give me the text and stuff to pronounce, I will go into it. I want to be able to speak about these things with depth and with meaning. And myths are just so full of meaning and angst and pain and hope and dreams and just fun stories, fun facts, fun stories, you know, stories being what they are.
They're just so universal. They just,
so
very, you know, that's the thing, right? They're universal stories. And even when the time period, the politics, the people, everything is so different from us today. Like, the stories themselves are just human stories.
Yep.
And that's what makes them so fascinating. And it is so interesting to look at them. Like, I mean, obviously that's what I do on this show, is look at the myths from a modern lens and look at them, you know, in the world that they were in, and also try to pull apart, you know, what it means for us today, and also often, you know, how the world they were in then, you know, isn't necessarily, it's more so it's influenced by the outside factors, you know, like the people who don't like my show love to complain about very set things of like, oh, I do. But it's entertaining now. Thankfully, I've reached a level where, you know, it doesn't bother me. Like, I'm – but it's so interesting because they tell on themselves in their reviews so often.
Sure.
You know, like the latest one I got was somebody who was like, she hates them. She hates the men. She clearly hates her life choices.
Oh, my gosh.
This is what she's doing. And I'm like, I have been doing this for 4 years, and like, I make a full living off of – reading or of researching mythology and bringing it to people. Like, I don't hate anything about these myths. I just think maybe if I'm telling a story where a man assaults a woman, like, I'm gonna talk about like that like it's a bad thing, because it is.
Yeah.
Like, it's, yeah, you know, it's so interesting to the way people, you know, interpret that. But also, it's so interesting the way that it's understood by, and I don't necessarily mean academia in this because I'm so not in academia, but the way people understand myths and then hang on to them as this, like, you know, original myth, that term, that nonsensical term of, you know, the way people want to treat specifically so often, say, Hesiod, as if like, Hesiod's stories were the be all and end all. It was absolutely what all of ancient Greece believed, and you cannot deny that.
Yeah,
and it's like the absurdity of that. So many pieces of that are so wrong, you know? like, you know, regionality aside, the idea that just because this one man's writing is all we have on a certain thing, or the earliest that we have on a certain thing, you know, doesn't remotely suggest that it's what everyone believed, that it was, you know, widely understood. Like, it's so interesting to look at it and just kind of consider what else might have existed then, what people might have believed that might have completely contradicted something that Hesiod said, but we don't have it. All we have is Hesiod, and, you know, kind of what that means for what we believe. Often it to me, it comes down to the way women were treated, because I'm sure that there were so many stories where the women weren't, you know, treated like garbage, or, you know, where we have these like other understandings of certain things that we just don't happen to have them because either they weren't written down or they got lost, or the reason they weren't written down was because it wasn't the powerful men telling those stories, right? And so, like, of course, those are the people whose stories are getting written down and passed on. And it's just so interesting to consider the things that we don't have that might have existed back then, because, you know.
I think that's why I find Sappho and Corinna so interesting. The fact that they were written about so respectfully, you know, like, it's a fact. Okay, these are fabulous women poets, and they're the best poets of their time, especially Sappho and her playing her songs. And it's like, and there was no derision whatsoever. Mm-hmm. You know, when they say these things, like, no, not even a hint, like, and it was wrong for her to do, or like anything, or for a woman, it was just like, no, she was the best. And so it makes me wonder, regionally, was something going on with Lesbos at the time, which is interesting, because it's smacking right there, like the border of, you know, the mainland Turkey today, like, what was Leto coming from also around that area, seems to have, right? And her children going this way.
Right.
In the myths, she was not welcome. She and her birth and her children were not welcome in the beginning. And like, oh my gosh, and now Apollo is like Greek and Roman, and they didn't even bother changing his name. He's so great. Like, but in the beginning, you know, it's something about that movement from east to west. Aphrodite also, east to west. Like, these are Eastern gods, Dionysus as well.
Oh, yeah.
Eastern gods who were later accepted, venerated, and became so very Greek, right? Mm-hmm. Well, especially Apollo. Mm-hmm. Like,
I find Apollo so fascinating for the Roman of it. Mm-hmm. That is so interesting that he's like the only god who has the same name, save for Bacchus being, you know, a Greek name of Dionysus as well. But yeah, Apollo being Apollo is so fascinating. And then on top of that, like, I think it's so interesting how he sort of took over so many important things from other gods.
You know, god, sun god. I mean, how?
Sun god, absolutely. How? That's the most obvious one. Right? Yeah. Like, poor Helios. Sorry, guy, you're gone. Yeah. You know? But even, like, you know, before that became sort of the accepted, like, Apollo's the god of the sun, which, of course, is quite, you know, happened later. But even just the fact that he, you know, you have these muses, you have these goddesses of art and music, but Apollo's the real god of art and music. And he's kind of this, like, umbrella of the muses. You know, he kind of holds them in. And then same with the oracle. You know, the oracle was originally this matriarchal kind of figure, deity, more so connected with Gaia and all of this. And then Apollo comes and he takes over oracular prophecy, just like he took over all these things. And to me, he is so fascinating that way, because he became this supremely important figure, the sun god, this god of everything.
Healing, music.
Yeah, everything beautiful and important and planned. Yeah. But then, to have him having sort of explicitly, you know, not in the stories, taken these things from these goddesses, but you can see how he did. You know, you can't see kind of when it happened, but the fact that there are the muses and the Oracle and all of this, but they all fall under the umbrella of Apollo.
They're all connected to him. Yeah. Even like people forget when I say, "Oh yeah, it's Zeus and his oracles." They're like, "No, I thought it was Apollo." And I'm like, "No, it's Zeus and his oracles." And then Zeus, even in him to Hermes, says, "You know, Apollo will have has my oracles. It's just him. It's just him, son." Mm-hmm. He says to Hermes, "I'm sorry, you can't also have the oracle thing going on." But we'll throw in the bee women to you.
I don't think I know what about the bee women.
Oh, yes.
What is the story with the bee women?
Oh, my gosh. So in Hymn to Hermes, and this is a song that I started as well, there's this part where the bee women are three women who have wings, and they tell oracles. And he can hang out with them. He's allowed to hang out with them. But that's as close as he can get to oracles. He himself can't be partaking in oracles as Zeus and Apollo can, but he can hang out with them. But it's like, okay, very interesting. Tell me more about these bee women. Well, when they have honey, you must feed them, because if you don't feed them honey, then they become very upset. If you feed them honey, then they will give you oracles.
Amazing.
I know.
I love
it. Hymn to Hermes. Yeah.
I feel like I read a portion of the Hymn to Hermes on the podcast, but it's so long that I cut off and I thought I'd read the rest, but maybe I didn't.
Oh, now you gotta read it.
I have to go back and finish it.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I started a song.
Yeah.
I composed the song, but I just haven't recorded. I have so many songs. I haven't recorded. Like, what I tend to do is I give a rough draft version. I'm like, this is a song I composed. I haven't recorded it, but here it is. And if you guys are interested, you know, like, Patreon me, which I only started like a month ago, you know.
Do you have a Patreon now?
I do. I do have a Patreon now, Liv.
So, good. I will share it all in the podcast. No, I have a habit of joining. I think I'm a patron of like every classics person.
I just started it like a month ago, and and it's just my name. It's just Bettina Jordy Guzman.
I was gonna ask.
Yeah. It's, you know, I hung back from doing Patreon for the longest time because I had nothing to offer except my, like, I have no time to do tiers. Like, if you do this, then I give you this. I'm like, no, that's the whole point, is I don't have time. But I believed in the idea of learning about ancient music and putting it out to the public and not having it stuck in academic journals. Not that I have time anyway as a public high school teacher.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. And with a 14-year-old child, a son, most people would be like, whoa. And you know, you're a single working mother and you do that. And that must be everything. I go, yeah, somehow I carve out time to also study up on, theater and ancient Greek music and ancient music in general, even, and give it to the public, because that was the reason I wanted to do it in the first place. I mean, you know, my first couple songs was out of curiosity. I'm like, I didn't know about this in grad school, and I would like people to know about it who are in grad school or undergrad, and I would like my high school students to know about it. And not have it, you know, written in an academic journal and then that's all and they'll never see it. So when I try to interview people for California Classical Association South, which is a panel I put together twice a year, when I had put together that panel for CHS, for Center for Hellenic Studies, the idea was, and then I would have that right to put it out in the public, you know, or at least link there stuff over to the public so that they can access it. And because a journal is only for academics, really. Nobody reads it. I'm sorry, they don't. They don't.
No, I mean, I don't. Yeah.
Because it's too dense. The material is too dense and too,
well, it's, you know. It's more so also about like trying to find those things.
That's
like
it too.
You know, if you're not in that world, you just don't know where they look. You don't know where they're coming out. You know, like no one has the time to just start searching around constantly everywhere for all the different. Yeah.
And if it's stuck just in JSTOR and, you know, it's got a paywall.
Oh, exactly.
So I would much rather like ask a lovely, friendly academic like, you know, Armand Dunger, can you please talk about, you know, ancient music? Stefan Hagel, can you please talk about, you know, the Aulos to us? since you're an expert, can you talk about this? Or even mm-hmm. out of that world, interviewing Andy West with his upcoming book about prison life and how classics helped. What is that all about? Like, what is the connection? What do people in prison think about the classics? How does it relate to them and all that? You know, I think mm-hmm. about those things. Like, how else would anybody know that those things exist unless mm-hmm. it's like put in a podcast or put in a YouTube channel where it's accessible? Like, how mm-hmm. would you know?
I mean, yeah, Yeah, it sounds like so much of why I, you know, have my podcast and all of those things, because it is just, it's so lovely to spread those things more broadly.
Yeah.
And beyond the realm of academia.
Well, you know, my kids love your podcast. And so I will have to just really go through and say, you know, which ones, or just blip out certain things that, so in case, you know, when my admin comes in and says, what are you watching? And the whole thing can be actually watched, and it's like, yes, we're talking, you know, myth, and because my kids love myth so very much, and mm-hmm. whether it's my ancient Greek class or my Latin class, you know, there's a certain point where we talk just myth, and especially the weird wild stuff. And let me just close up the episode, because we've been talking now for like 2 hours.
I know, yeah. I mean,
I can keep talking to you forever, Liv. You know, this is just, if you ever want me to be a guest of it, you know, later, whatever. Goodness. I mean, obviously I can talk on and on about stuff. But, you know, I just want to close up. And that's why I mm-hmm. love to sing about especially female deities and mm-hmm. queens, because I just feel like they're just not celebrated enough. Okay, I'll have to say I have my exceptions, like Apollo and Hermes, but then that's because the bee women are in Hermes and also Apollo's muses, but they're just so odd and weird. But Artemis, mm-hmm. I want to sing of Artemis the huntress, Artemis the, also she plays the lyre. She's depicted in many iconography as playing the lyre and dancing along with her brother. Mm-hmm. But like, we always just think, oh, you know, Artemis the huntress, Artemis the whatever, moon goddess, you know, and the virgin goddess. But it's like, yeah, but also Artemis, like the one who plays the lyre and hangs out and sings and dances. So I've pictured her as like, have you ever seen capoeira dancing and women like dancing capoeira?
I have not.
So powerful. Oh my gosh. Because here's this like bow-like instrument, right? That's just this. Mm. And that's going on. And the women are dancing capoeira. And I'm like, oh, I would picture Artemis dancing like that, with that sound of the bowstring going on. And she's doing war dances, basically war training style dances. Mm-hmm. So that's how I picture her in my head.
It's very Artemis.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, more than just like doing the circle dances. I mean, circle dance is good and all, but acrobatic dancing while circle dancing? Yeah, most definitely. Most definitely.
Interesting. I've never thought about any of that. Those parts, it's never, the music and the dancing and everything has never kind of come up for me. So this is just so interesting. It's so different. Well, this has been so wonderful. Thank you so much. Why don't you tell everyone where to find you? And I'll link to everything in the episode's description as well. But just tell all my listeners where they can learn more and where they can listen to your music and all these different things.
Oh, yes. Okay. So, listeners of this glorious podcast, I can be found on just BettinaJoyDeGuzman.com. I know I have a long name. I'm sorry. And for Bettina Joy happens to be a common Filipino name, apparently. So it has to be the whole thing. All right. BettinaJoyDeGuzman.com. And that, once you go there, it has all my links to YouTube music, YouTube, my own channel, Spotify, Amazon, so therefore Amazon Music, and there's Apple Music there. I'm just in all the major
You're
ones.
Everywhere.
Deezer.
Yeah.
What have you. All up, all there. Up. Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, I will link so that people don't have to type in your name. I'll link to an episode description, which means people are more likely to visit it because they don't have to type it in. So just check the episode's description.
Thank you.
This has been so much fun. nerds. Thank you all so much, as always. It's just so much fun to have these conversations. I actually went through like a bit of a stint last month where I recorded like 9 or 10 in 1 week, I think, or in 2 weeks rather. That would have been too much. But Bettina Joy was one of them, and it was just so much fun. There was so much going on in my head at all the times because I had spoken to so many people in such short period of time. So anyway, it was really so much fun. I absolutely love these conversations, as I say every time, but they're just such a thrill. It's so cool to learn everything myself and then teach it all to you guys through these conversations. It's quite fun. I feel very lucky. Thank you all so much for listening. As always, a quick reminder to please submit your questions to the beginning of the new year Q&A. That's mythsbaby.com/questions. And stay tuned for Helen next week. Fucking Helen. Oh my God. Cannot wait for it. Thank you all. I am Liv and I love this shit.
We went from normal life, healthy child to acute lymphoblastic leukemia or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
Are you tired of your scented cleaning products smelling and cleaning like meh? Then it's time for an upgrade with the power of Clorox Scentiva. With an uplifting scent that smells like coconut, Clorox Scentiva gives you powerful clean like Clorox, but a feeling like being transported to a tropical island retreat. Imagine putting your phone on Do Not Disturb, tuning out all the constant, just the feeling of warm sand in between your toes and a fruity drink in your hand. The ones with the little umbrella. Refresh your home to feel like an all-inclusive vacation by getting Clorox Scentiva. Also available in grapefruit and lavender scents at a nearby retail store.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.